This is the Mindful Musical Life Podcast. I'm Kevin Miske. Hello, everybody. Today I am speaking with Benjamin Irons. In addition to his active life as a professional orchestral percussionist, Ben is a sound healer, meditation instructor, and artist collaborator with Dragonfly Percussion. Through his private practice, Zen with Ben, based in Boulder, Colorado, he works extensively with sound and vibration as a form of alternative medicine for stress-related conditions. He holds a BM in instrumental performance from Northern Arizona University, as well as certifications from the University of Holistic Theology, the Southwestern Institute of Healing Arts, and the Atmabhuti Sound and Vibrational School in Boulder, Colorado. He is a proud member of the International Association of Meditation Instructors, Sound Healers Association, and the American Federation of Musicians. Outside of his wellness practice, Mr. Irons currently serves as the principal percussionist with the Flagstaff Symphony Orchestra. And as a freelancer, he has performed throughout the United States, Europe, and China, most notably with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, San Diego Symphony, Hawaii Symphony, Phoenix Symphony, Tucson Symphony, Arizona Philharmonic, and the Arizona Opera Orchestras. In this conversation, we discuss Ben's approach to teaching and practicing mindfulness, as well as his excellent new book, Mindfulness for Musicians, A Practical Guide. Ben is a passionate and kind person and teacher, and I think you will really enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here's Ben. Ben, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to hear about all the things you're doing with mindfulness, your new book, and all your great practices.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Happy to be here. Great to chat about these topics.
Absolutely. So why don't we start? One of my favorite places to start is where you got interested in mindfulness, when and why, and kind of what your practice looks like today, how it's evolved, how it's changed, anything along those lines.
Yeah, thanks. What a great question. So I found myself in a mindfulness niche through a misconception, the way that most people probably approach it in the West for the first time, thinking that it was a way to clear my mind and learning very quickly that that isn't actually how that works or how that process goes. But essentially, I had finished my undergraduate program at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, and I was out on the audition circuit trying to win myself a position as a percussionist with a symphony. And I didn't have necessarily a lot of music performance anxiety in college. I mean, yeah, you feel the pressure like when you're in your juries or in your recitals, but it was really auditioning that I started to notice like, oh my God, I'm panicking. And not even really panicking so much as I remember my first audition sort of becoming conscious, so to speak, or aware. And I was like halfway through a xylophone excerpt and I didn't even remember starting it. And I was like, oh my God, I need to look into a solution for this. You know, when you're practicing so hard for so long and then all of a sudden you've just like not even, you know, you go into autopilot in the worst possible timing. So I set out to learn meditation, thinking that it would clear my mind of any of the negative stuff that was coming up, that self-chatter voice that's telling you like, oh my God, you are way off base here. Like, what do you think you're doing? You know? And so I set out to learn meditation and fell in love with it immediately and was kind of having this internal, like, you know, epiphany of like, why aren't people talking about this? You know, this practice that's 5,000 years old and had never right. come up at any point in my schooling.
Yeah, it's so surprising when you realize how helpful it is and how established it is in so many parts around the world in different formats, but generally speaking, it is surprising that especially in the performative arts, the live performative arts, how neglected that topic is in a lot of places. But I'm happy that you found it, just like I'm happy that I found it too.
Yeah, and there's small ways to approach it, right? And there's different lineages. So I think what I really appreciate about mindfulness or meditation practice and meditation being a specific practice laboratory setting for a generalized lifestyle of mindfulness. And so you're using this laboratory setting to get you into, you know, places when you can't practice. It's the old train and trust that comes in, you know, from the music side where it's like, yeah, you're going to practice all these things, but at a certain point you can't stop in a performance and practice. You got to trust what you're doing and just let it flow for where you are in that moment and just accept it for better or worse. You know, like this is where you're at. And so at a certain point you're surrendering that control of that product and of your, you know, experience. But anyway, so what I love about music and mindfulness in particular and blending these worlds together is I work extensively with sound and vibration currently. And there's so many similarities to those musical performances and musical sensations that overlap with our kind of traditional, I come from a Vipassana lineage or insight meditation. So a lot of overlaps in the essence of the practice is that you're connecting with the present moment. And just like it's very difficult to take a previous breath or a future breath, and if you figure it out, please let me know. It's the same thing with sound. Like, sound's really only ever in the present moment. It's very difficult to meditate on a sound or re-perform a sound that's already happened. And it's just as difficult to meditate on a sound that hasn't happened yet. And so I love kind of connecting these worlds because there are these just like very flash in the pan style, like just unique experiences. If we can train ourselves to release our doubt and, you know, anxiety about what we're doing and just kind of embrace it for the moment of like what a gorgeous expression that we're capable of as musicians.
That's such a key point to think about as a parallel is the in the momentness of performing, especially when you're considering live performance. I mean, recording is a whole nother type of performance really, but in the moment live performance. And for a lot of people, I think considering the audition angle, I came to it from a very similar reason, like, oh, well, I can hack my brain through mindfulness to be a better horn player. You know, like that was the goal of mindfulness for a long time. But then as many do, we figure out that it's not just about that. But the parallel of acknowledging the present moment, and you talk a lot about this in your new book, Mindfulness for Musicians, talking about the breath as kind of like a really key anchor to a lot of different practices and a lot of different levels of awareness and training. So do you want to talk a little bit about kind of that breath and kind of keep going down that thread of using the breath to create that awareness of the present moment?
Sure. Thank you. So the breath we use for a couple key reasons. And again, it's worth mentioning if you're new to meditation or if you're, you know, haven't quite taken the leap of faith yet and give it a chance. The yogic breath is kind of what we traditionally call it of meditation and mindfulness and yoga, contemplative practices, qigong, tai chi, very, very different from what your maybe teachers have taught you if you're a wind player or a vocalist. So just saying off the bat that when I speak about the breath, I'm speaking specifically about like this kind of contemplative breath and not your technical musical breath. But we use it for a couple key reasons. I mean, one, it's inexpensive. It's super portable and it's always accessible. And if you at any point find that your breath is not accessible, you have a much bigger urgency and please disregard your meditation and seek medical attention immediately. And because we have these moments from the ego mind, we call it, these fears, anxiety, doubt, worry, restlessness, these experiences, you can see them, like you witness them in yourself. And the fact that you can witness it means that the true you is at a layer further back yet. And so this is another misconception about meditation. And so folks always say like, oh, I don't know how to do it. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know, you know, when to do it. And it's actually not something you have to do. It's something you're undoing. It's a process of removing those filters of fear and anxiety, anger in some cases that we've been kind of placed onto our experience. And so the breath, because our mind, the technical, you know, consciousness, tries to, it doesn't like being disconnected from. It's always kind of there whispering in your ear, you know. And so like I mentioned earlier, like the meditation for me, I thought I was going to clear my mind. Well, it doesn't work that way. You know, your brain is an electrical device and the neurons are firing, you know, thousands of times per second. And so there's always going to be something from the mind. And so it's more about kind of parsing out what's relevant and what's helpful and what's not helpful. And, so as you're breathing and as you're working with the meditation, because the breath is constantly moving, you have this anchor to come back to time and time again. So even if you miss it right now, and I remember writing this a little bit in the book and it just stood out to me again about that Spaceballs scene where they're chatting with Darth Helmet, if old Mel Brooks movie 80s. Anyway, dating myself quickly. talking about the now. It's like, right now? Well, now is now. Now is now then, and now we're now. Anyway. But the breath.
I like the reference. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
I'm there with you.
Thanks.
Oh, yeah.
The wisdom of Rick Moranis there. And,
right.
but you always have these chances as your mind wanders off, and it might be 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times in a meditation session, but you always have that chance to come back to the breath again. Because the present moment's not something you can think about. You have to feel into it. And so you connect with that sensation of the breath and any other kind of peripheral sensations in the body that come up related to that.
Yeah, there's so much good in there that you just covered. So let's go back and hit a couple key things. One thing was the idea of undoing, where meditation is something that it is an act. It is an intentional thing. When you're doing formal meditation, you know, there's a certain amount of intentionality to it, but the results of mindfulness are not so much of like an accomplishment as they are an undoing. And I remember that being a very specific, you know, a point that you were making several times in your book. So can you touch on that just a little bit more about this balance between undoing and, you know, achievement, that kind of that relationship, if you will?
Sure. And it feels so contradictory to what we're learning from conservatory, right? Or from our musical training, where you're really rear facing everything to like kind of really focus in on the stuff that's not going well, the things that you want to, you know, hone or sculpt or not be reprimanded for and or called out for. And so this is, I think, where people have a hard time connecting with their meditation practice, because I remember a friend of mine called me up. She'd been meditating for about a month and we'd been working on some techniques. And she was just exhausted. And she just said, I don't understand. Like, I've been meditating for 30 days. Why aren't I happy? And it's like, well, meditation doesn't make you happy. You're not happy because you're not happy. It just shows you what's there. And so, so I think people avoid it because we're in this culture of instant gratification. We want the results immediately. I want to post. I want to see my likes. I want to feel that boost of attention you know, fame and all these things. But meditation doesn't work that way. It's a slow game and it's a subtle, nuanced game. And so one of the questions that comes up frequently for me is that people ask is like, well, you know, what do you gain from meditation? And I hate to tell you this, you don't gain anything, but you release so many negative qualities in your mind and in your spirit that aren't serving you. Like I mentioned, fear, anxiety, doubt, worry, restlessness, and, you know, you surrender control. And so as you're working on your meditation practice, it's so strange to tell you, like, well, there aren't like milestones of like marked quantitative results. You know, it's not a productive capitalist system. And so it's this process of undoing, but we haven't noticed that things have been kind of glazed over our sort of essential essence, what they call the silent witness in kind of more woo realms. You might hear of like the cosmic self. I really like this concept of chustness that comes from old American psychologist Will James. And I don't need to go too deeply into that. But so you, as the core of you that hasn't been influenced by trauma and injury and gaslighting and all these things that come up in our society, even external expectations in a lot of way, and some misinformed internal expectations, all of these things add different filters to a lens that you're seeing the world through. And so as you sit in meditation, you can see these things. You know, you see a thought come in about, I should text that girl back. Or you see a thought, oh, I wonder if that new episode on Netflix is up yet. And but these things aren't serving you. They're not in the present. This is your mind kind of throwing you curveballs. And so it's not you, because you're witnessing it. And so through our meditation, we're slowly connecting back just to our being. And so we tend to think of ourselves as a noun being, as fused pieces of flesh and bone and nerves and blood. But in fact, at a quantum level, if we want to get into the mechanics of it, we are verb beings. You are shimmering in and out of existence at a rapid rate. It's the difference between a photograph and a film. And so how, you know, a movie seems like a live action, but it's actually a series of photographs that's played so quickly that it gives the illusion of movement. And we're like that too. So we think that we're a solid piece, but we're mainly air and water, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah, you mentioned the chestness, which I did pick up on. I thought that would be a really interesting thing to talk about, but we can, I think, plan a deeper dive into a little bit more of that area, the more like, psychological, analytical slash deeper Buddhist teachings and things like that at our next interview.
For sure.
I think that would be a great place to talk about for sure. I think a good place to tail to would be this placement of non-judgment, because I think that's so crucial to all practices. And you touch on that several times as well in your book. But when these thoughts arise, oftentimes, like all of us, but especially people who are fairly new to meditation, they'll see thoughts arise and the reaction is one of, oh, I failed. Right. Oh, I'm bad at meditation because I keep having these random thoughts that distract me or whatever. So let's kind of hone in on that idea of non-judgment for just a second and kind of zoom in on that and elaborate on that concept a little bit more, tying to what you're talking about with the undoing idea and dealing with the ego mind kind of around that concept.
Sure. So I do have some good news, and I wish that this was brought up more often, and I cannot overemphasize this if you're starting out in your meditation practice, or even if you've never heard this before and you just need some external permission. There is no right or wrong way to meditate, and especially in the beginning when you're starting out, and there's also no good or bad meditations. So immediately the judgment kind of goes out the window, and I was reading something recently about from the anatomical standpoint of how our mind processes things, there's two different globalized regions for both curiosity and a separate one for judgment. And so it's actually like almost physically impossible to be both curious and judgmental at the same time. So if you're feeling kind of judgmental, if you're just noticing immediately that you've put some sort of just some sort of judgment on a thought or on an observation, maybe give yourself a little bit of curiousness. Maybe ask yourself why or how, and just kind of start to diffuse that a little bit. But I always finish my meditation sessions by journaling, because I learn, just like when I'm practicing music, I want to try to remember what I'm focusing on, what worked well for me that session, what maybe wasn't as quite as skillful, and see right there was an example. So I never frame things as good or bad. Like, this didn't go well. Like, this was poor. I'm bad at this. I did this wrong. It's just kind of degrees of more or less skillful, because the fact that you're there on the cushion doing the work, like the fact that you showed up, is already kind of a win at the core of it. And so just giving yourself permission just to know that you can't do it wrong. You may not have as skillful of a day, but even just showing up, you are contributing to your practice, and therefore the practice of your lineage or of the people around you. It does change the energy of your day. And ultimately what we're trying to work toward, and one of the things that I really appreciate about a mindfulness practice, is that it gives you space in your thoughts and in how you interact with other people. And you kind of go from a life of reaction to one of response. And the key difference being there is you're bringing in an intention, and you have an opportunity to make a choice that feels good to you in how you respond to a situation. We've all had that situation where you've maybe said that one phrase under your breath to your mom, as like a kid, and she caught it, and you knew as soon as you said it, like, oh, I shouldn't have done it. Like, we've all had those situations. And if you're a professional musician, how often on stage you kind of reach a boiling point and someone says something snarky, and it just causes more issues, right, than just like kind of having an intentional, mindful response to a situation. And so these practices give you that space to approach those stimuli with good intentions, or with, skillful communication practices, or communication that elevates the folks around you.
Yeah, the idea of response versus reaction, I use that same terminology, funny enough, because it's such a good description of like two sides of that same coin, right? A thought comes in, or someone says something to you, and you have that split second where if a reaction is going to happen, like oftentimes if we're not being as aware as we could be of the present moment, then a reaction will escape before you can acknowledge it, or before you can observe that it's happening. Right.
Yeah.
But deepening our ability to observe thoughts as they enter our mind as kind of external objects almost, that are filtering in through and coming away and in and out, then we can catch those thoughts and say, oh, that's probably not going to be helpful in this moment. Maybe I won't say anything, or I'll say this instead. Right.
Yeah.
And it's so helpful to train that skill away from our music and then to bring it back into a practice room and a performance. So do you want to talk a little bit about that specific element when it comes to our the part of us that are musicians?
Yeah, thank you. I think those are beautiful observations. And I was I was catching on for the first time as you were speaking that there's actually even a linguistic element to those words, where the reaction itself is, it's a very snappy, fast word. It's almost out before you have a chance, and even respond slows down. There's a length to it. Anyway, neither here nor there. I just think
it's, I like that though. That's good observation from you as well.
There's a subconscious sort of thing there that's unfolding that I think is really interesting. So when you're working with these tools and you're starting to fold them in, you know, yes, you want to practice away and try to develop time. And as you're getting started, I think short periods many times is the way to go, and sort of getting used to having that kind of sensation come up in your day. And so it's much more beneficial to practice your meditation 2 minutes a day rather than 60 minutes once a week. I think, again, there's this misconception that you have to carve out this monastic lifestyle of an hour a day at sunrise up in the cave somewhere. And and I'm sort of I'm a modern practitioner in the sense of that I really don't meditate too much in the morning. I actually tend to meditate more in the afternoons and evening. So much of our music life is actually more geared towards the evening. I don't really do much, other than the occasional church gig that's, 6:30, and there's plenty of times in those venues to connect with my breath. Sorry, to answer your question, working with this, I might have to have you rephrase that one more time for me. Will you remind me what we're talking about?
Yeah, of course. No. You were there, but essentially the connection of training this response versus reactivity or reaction through thoughts, and then that connection to our training as musicians. So like when you're in the practice room and you're in your inner practice session, or if you're listening back to a mock audition tape, or, any situation where we have that same kind of option, and how beneficial that is, or how it interacts with your own experiences as a performing musician or in students that you've seen, or any examples you can think of.
Sure. Thank you. So we're in a performance arts ultimately, and there are degrees of external expectations as far as our image and how we present ourselves, our attitude, our professionalism. And so I think even on a surface level, getting used to noticing how you respond when things don't go the way that you hope they do, these little hiccups, these little glitches in our playing, not having a meltdown and having a little hissy fit about it and throwing things or shouting, or, just kind of, the game is hard enough, right? Music is already difficult. You're communicating under extreme circumstances with realistically not always the amount of planning or focus or intention that we would like to have in an ideal setting. And so everyone's always kind of playing catch up anyway. And so just recognizing you can contribute to a positive aspect of your community or to your school or to your studio rather than being another source of chaos. And even more than that, our culture right now is so volatile that I think any sort of anchors of calm and just self-responsibility and accountability for our actions, I think goes a really long way to maintaining our sanity. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so as you're practicing too, then you're just, as a performance art, things won't go perfectly. And I really like principal percussionist of Hawaii Symphony, Becca Lorido. She's doing a lot of energy healing, sound healing stuff now too. And I really appreciate that there's this shift now in Western musicians to kind of look at these Eastern practices and how they blend into how we can be better. There's this, from the percussion side, there's kind of two parallel tracks. There's this Western track of percussion that has just technical precision and accuracy and quality of sound and the approach of these instruments. But our mental health is not always great. And I'm being generous there. But on the Eastern side, then, from percussion, there's this long lineage of really great, healthy self-care practices, but their approach to music is very, very different and more intuitive than ours. And so we're trying to find this way to blend these worlds together. But I appreciate one of the insights that Becca had about this was You know, we always seek this kind of technical precision of excellence of like, you never miss a note and everything's exactly sculpted the way that you want. And it's like a machine almost. And then when I start to think about how often our machines fail on us, like I don't trust my machine. I trust humans way more than my devices around me, and how, you know, the powerlessness that I feel even just when I try to connect to Bluetooth and there's like nothing you can do but offer up like, okay, please Lord Ganesha, like help this Bluetooth connection go through. Like it's all beyond me. There's this kind of surrendering of what, you know, control what you can, let go what you can't. And so I think there's, you know, there's these subtle shades of how these things blend together in our performance practices about, you know, it's never going to be perfect. I mean, this is why we love music in the first place. There's never going to be a day that someone's like, oh, I'm done. I've done it all. I've played every piece right. In every key, at every tempo, and every dynamic, at every style. There's nothing left. I've finished. Mm. And this is why we chase this thing. And so knowing that that's like one of the drives behind it is like we're always, there's more to our artistry all the time. You know, you start to, through your mindfulness practice, then realize like, just where are you now? How are you today? Like, it's great you want to get better. It's great you're chasing that. I'm very nervous about people who are like, no, I don't study with anyone. I don't learn anything. I don't read anything. I'm done now. And just like, what? Like, there's no way. And
that's a really interesting point. The lack of continued education that's kind of stigmatized, specifically, in my view, it's like instrumentalists. I think vocalists tend to be a little bit more comfortable with the idea of like a lifelong coach,
yeah,
you know, or different coaches, obviously. But, you know, the idea of needing outside, you know, input, like even at the highest levels of performance. And I do think it takes a fair amount of comfort in the ideas that you're talking about of acknowledging imperfection within all of us to be able to take criticism, you know. I mean, sometimes there's certain types of criticism that are not helpful,
yeah.
Right? That maybe you should say thank you, but no thank you. You don't need that kind of, you know, blind, unhelpful, undirected or criticism. But a lot of times it's if you can take comments in a way that disconnects from your own self-worth, right? That's the hard part.
Yeah.
I think the training that you can get from, you know, this kind of from mindfulness meditations of all the varying degrees of distancing or disconnecting yourself with your thoughts, that like just because you're having a thought doesn't mean that it is you, that idea I think is hard for a lot of people to understand unless you've gone through a little bit of mindfulness practice on your own or with a teacher or whomever. But it's so crucial to be able to say, you know, oh, you know, this note in this passage that I was working on was this. It was sharp, it was flat, it was a little early, it was late, you know, I missed it, or whatever it happens to be. But that doesn't mean that I'm a bad musician because of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. And it's a subtle shade between, like, I think it's a lot easier for us to recognize, you know, especially as you get more into your music practice and if you're at like a professional level and no matter where you are in your career. Like you said, sometimes there's critical feedback that comes back and you recognize immediately, like, this is misinformed or this is a diversion from my intention or from my, you know, what I'm trying to achieve and express. And it's a very subtle discernment between when that comes from an outside source and when that comes from an inside source. And when it's your own thoughts that are leading you astray in that way, and you have to recognize, like, oh, that thought's not serving me. Like, that doesn't do me any good. And then letting that go so that you can be at peace with your practice and with your artistry so that you stay enchanted and stay connected and stay motivated to keep growing, keep expressing your art, keep working with your colleagues to find just like that next level of just like juicy music.
Yeah, it's nice to be reminded that being a musician does not have an end goal, really. There are moments in the timeline where you can have, you know, a big moment that you're shooting for, you know, like a big audition or a big concerto performance or a recital or whatever it might be. But those are points on the continuum. And, you know, I brought that up. That's been brought up in previous interviews on this podcast. But it's worth repeating that that our life is a never ending continuum of music and of growth and of exploration and performance, and that one note in that one concert is not is not the end of your, you know, musical life or, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah. And we have choices around that stuff too. So, I mean, to a degree, you know, there's 10-year process and these types of things. But I think it's worth mentioning, you know, the way that when you've worked with a group for a while, let's say you have a home base, whether it's an orchestra or a choir, your studio that you're in for your collegiate career or something, you know, when you're watching other people play, generally, if someone chips something, you can acknowledge that, you hear it. There's very few times that you're like, oh, that person missed that note. Boy, what are they doing here? They should question their life. They should get out of here. Like, I can't believe this. Like, what an injustice that they're in this program. You know, it's rarely that degree. It's like, it's usually more like, oh, that's strange. Like, normally that was going really well in rehearsal. Well, I know that they try. I know that they really wanted to make that happen. And you know what? We'll play this piece again. They'll get another shot at it. Or it's more like, oh, that's, you know, normally, oh, I didn't even really notice. Like, that was a subtle thing. But it's so different when we criticize ourselves and when we look at how we're playing that we tend to go the other way. It's just like, what am I doing here? I can't believe I'm doing this. I can't believe I missed this note, you know? And we're so much harder on our own experiences than we are on others.
Yeah, there's an idea where if you are... the concept of being, you know, completely at peace and okay with right where you are in this present moment, in this present day, like working on that skill, you know, within a mindful context, there's an idea that if you do that, then you'll stop trying to get better, right? This falsehood that's viewed within mindfulness of, oh, well, you'll just get all super passive and, you know, wishy-washy and you won't ever try any harder. You'll just kind of like, you know, melt into oblivion and never try to accomplish anything. I'm sure you've experienced that viewpoint in one way or another. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how you kind of approach that subject?
Sure. I mean, I don't see a direct relationship between the two. I mean, someone's motivation for how they act or go about their day is very different, and than how they're, you know, being aware of that moment. So yes, I mean, you could potentially surrender completely and not try anymore, and you could live the rest of your day just breathing until you didn't eat either or these things, right. But that doesn't, there's not a direct correlation, you know. So you could also be a very hyper energetic and very A-level kind of attention to detail and also bring in a sense of, you know, control what you can, let go what you can't, let today be your, you know, as an old practitioner, Carolyn Bremer passed away, used to say, do your best and let that be enough. And it just gives you permission to have a parachute in case something doesn't go the way that you're planning. Like to let you know, like your whole self-worth, your whole identity is not wrapped up in this. And for me, even too, at a deeper kind of Buddhist level, I can't prove that other people are real, which gets into a whole new level of permission where it's like, oh yeah, even if I screw up, like, I don't know that people are here. It gets very matrixy in that way. Right. But if everything is vibrations and light, waves of light reflected off those, that's interpreted by our brain, then, you know, does any of this exist if I'm not here? You know, anyway, so that gets into a whole new level, but it's very different to approach your playing, you know, just knowing like you could be the only one. In fact, you are the only one. No one's really paying as close attention as you are. And are you paying attention? And just allowing yourself to be, you know, whether that is in a period of rest. And we were talking briefly about productivity before we came on, but whether it's a period of rest, which rest and sloth are not the same thing, or if it's, you know, you're in a motivated, if you're like, you know, you got a goal that you're working towards to achieve, you know, there's room for mindfulness and all these things. But if you're the type of person that, you know, if mindfulness gives you permission to never do anything and give up, you were probably on that track to begin with. I hate to say that, but.
That's a very fair point, because as we've talked about, mindfulness doesn't add anything really to you. It's taking things away. Mm-hmm. So we're clearing away, you know, debris that kind of exposes what's underneath. So I do think it helps us to understand our truer selves a bit more.
Yeah.
Regardless of the outcome.
If you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it.
Right. Yeah. It's easy to obscure it with all of the input that we get in our daily lives between devices and sounds and, you know, screens and constant influx of information, but also of connectivity, people trying to get a hold of you or ask you questions or,
yeah,
you know, answering emails, the endless loop that is the email inbox, you know, and everything else. And it is an important reminder that if you want to know what's truly going on in your mind, as you said, you have to give time to see what's actually there.
Yeah.
So, another element that I'd love to touch on is the idea that you mentioned at the beginning of the lifestyle of mindfulness. So maybe can we talk about some ways for people, let's say that they're just getting started with a mindfulness practice on occasionally, and ways to incorporate kind of a mindfulness approach to different parts of their day.
Sure.
Or little suggestions on how to kind of check in or drop in here and there, you know, throughout a busy schedule, let's say.
Yeah. My favorite first way to kind of work with this is if we look at it from our practice kind of schedule, or if our studio schedule, teaching schedule, working with music in our day-to-day life, one of my favorite ways, again, with the goal of creating space, we have a lot of blurred lines in our life. We wake up and we sprint off the bed, and we sprint to the shower, sprint to the coffee machine, and sprint to our car, and there's opportunities here all the way through. And so my very favorite to start with, just notice how you feel, is when you get to your doorway, whether it's a separate bedroom, whether it's, you know, even if it's the same room, but there's different time periods. If you have a studio, or if you're on stage somewhere, stop before you walk through the doorway. Just stop and just give yourself a quick pause, kind of focus in for a second on what you're there to do. You know, so if you're about to walk into the room to practice, you're not there to check emails. You're not there to post on Facebook and bless all the musicians who are posting, you know, their 100-day challenges and things. But, you know, I really like the separation of the devices at the core of it. And so first, just stop and just check in with, you know, why are you there? What are you hoping to achieve? What isn't going to, you know, what can you leave outside? You know, you can visualize in these little suitcases or a cardboard box what you're not needing. You know, you don't need that fight with your significant other or with family members, with the, you know, that conductor. You can leave all that stuff outside. It's not going to serve you in your practice. It'll actually distract you. And so just give yourself a moment, you know, check in on your shoulders, drop them away from your ear, just see if there's any tension. And then when you're ready, take a deep breath and step into the door. And as you step in, you're actually creating a new chapter, a new kind of phase. And so if it's, let's say you're working from home, or if you're practicing at home, you know, leave the room. You know, if you've been putzing around on Call of Duty or whatever, and now it's time to practice, like, leave the room, cleanse the slate, take a breath, step back in. And it's almost like you pretend that you're in another situation, because you kind of are. I mean, from a time standpoint, time's not real. In this present moment, you're here to do a very different thing. So this, I like this too, like when you're walking to and from places, like from the car. So there's Thich Nhat Hanh talks about these bells of mindfulness, these little beeps that come up throughout our day. And so the one for me that always stands out is when I turn the car on, or there's always the beeping, you know, for a little while. And so you can use that as an audible cue to take a breath and just connect in, just deep breath in, deep breath out. How do I feel? What's going on? Release anything no longer serving you, as hippie as that sounds. But, you know, a lot of these negative emotions we carry around, this is an internal experience. You know, if you get cut off in traffic and you're shouting at the person in front of you, they don't feel or hear your anger, and they're on their way moments later. And then you're holding on to this, you're clutching this, you know, tension in your chest, this injustice of how could they do this to me? You don't need that while you're practicing. You know, you don't need that while you're driving. So you have these little things that are folded in throughout the day that you can use as little opportunities, little triggers to help you trigger in a positive way, to help you cue in on a moment that you could introduce some mindfulness. It doesn't involve 20 or 60 minutes on a cushion in isolation. You know, you have these built in everywhere.
Yeah, the trust of what you mentioned a little earlier on that I'll just repeat again to solidify is you spend time in your formal meditation settings, and then you have to trust that work that you did mm-hmm. is going to help, or is going to infiltrate into all these little nooks and crannies within your life. And the little moments to check in, I think it's when you realize it, and it's a victory to be celebrated, when you realize that you're slamming through something, or you've taken like 6 bites of your lunch and you have no idea what it tasted like, because you're thinking about something else, or when those moments of realization are to be celebrated, because it's in those moments that the reason that we practice mindfulness is for things like that.
Yeah.
Right. It's to these moments to be able to drop back in and kind of re-engage with the moment that we're in.
Yeah.
And Yeah, so I love the idea of clearing the slate before we enter into a new space or into a new part of our day, whatever that might be. How about things? I have some practices that I like to do when I'm like in the middle of a practice session. But do you have anything that you like to suggest for, let's say you've got, you know, an hour to practice? Very few of us, I think, can be totally engaged and present for a full hour without needing some kind of little reset. So what are some things that you like to do in that kind of a setting?
Yeah, so different, I think it's worth mentioning different focus on the, so when you focus on the breath, there's so many ways to do this. I mean, that's an extremely reductionist statement. But that's, you know, the core of what these practices, in my opinion, for meditation is. And, but it's worth mentioning that you can use the breath in different ways. So you can just watch it as an open observation. How, you know, what's it, what's the shape, what's the speed, what's the texture. But it's worth noting that different, the breath, just like sound, has different cycles. So there's an envelope, a sound envelope, right? There's an attack, sustain, decay, and then silence. And the breath does the same thing, very similar cycle of inhale, pause, exhale, pause. You could do an ocean breath, that kind of continuous in and out, but you might get a little, I might get lightheaded as a percussionist at high altitude. I don't have the same lung capacity that my wonderful wind colleagues do and opera colleagues. But if you're in your practice and you just need 2 minutes to break, a lot of times with those short sessions it's a hard, you know, it's our ego telling us like, you don't have time to do this. Like you got to get to that, get your scales, you know, whatever. But if you do take a minute or two at the beginning or at your kind of practice break, the way that you approach the rest of your practice session tends to be so much more focused and prioritized and just kind of gentle in a healthy way, that it's just a much better experience than feeling this slapdash, just insane, chaotic scramble frenzy to the finish line. And because then you're just trying to get it done. It's not about, you know, being fully engaged in the activity that you're working on. And so, but I should say that depending on how you look at the breath, that can help you. So if you're feeling frenzied, the exhalation part of your cycle will have a little bit more of a calming groundedness to it. And so you can actually, if we have like our box breath, they call it, you breathe in for four and hold for four, exhale four, hold for four. If you're feeling particularly frantic or frenetic, you can extend the exhalation. That'll help calm and focus. But if you're feeling a little bit lethargic, and I tend to be, again, a little bit, I move a little bit slower in the mornings, like my mornings to be mindful, but I tend to need energy more than anything. You know, the triple espresso only goes so far. But focusing on the inhalation actually brings more energy. And so if you're feeling lethargic, I think as you're going through your day and you have a little break, if you need some energy, sit for a minute, do your box breath, but do a longer inhalation. Maybe do 6 counts on the inhalation or 8 counts on the inhalation. And just notice, how does that change your experience? Does it give you energy? Does it hone your focus in a certain way? All these are observations. Everyone's experience is completely unique. These are things you have to learn for yourself as you go through your practice. But for me, that's kind of the thing that I look for when I'm in a practice session, and just like, what do I need in this moment? You know, do I feel frenzy and do I need a little bit more calm? Or do I need some more energy? And should I do one of these types of practices with that side of the, you know, of my cycle of breath? And I feel like there was something else there, but it got away from me now.
No, that's great. I think at the base of these great ideas as and these great ways to incorporate little moments of mindfulness in different places is the need for awareness. Like at the base of all this, it's hard to know that you need to take a second for a breath if you're not aware of the state that you're in any given moment.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good reminder that in order to be able to do these kinds of, you know, kind of middle of the day practices and to be able to acknowledge your need for them in the moments that matter most, we need to develop that sense of awareness, you know, in a more formal setting in some way, I think.
Yeah.
And I mean, please disagree with me if you so choose. But I think if it's 1 or 2 minutes, you know, before a practice session or in the morning or afternoon, whenever's best for you, but that kind of isolated training, wherever that may be and however that, whatever shape that takes for you, is really crucial to be able to use these smaller, more informal practices throughout your day.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm thinking too now about one of the moments with the orchestra and specifically that I really enjoy is when the tuning stuff happens, because there, you know, there's been classroom settings or I've taken some courses and things in the past where as a group, you either breathe together or chant together real quick before things get started. And some people might roll their eyes at that idea, but it is interesting because it gives you again space together as a community to slow down and like kind of check in with what you're there to do that day. And so when I think about the orchestra tuning, then it's really a nice time for me to check in with my breath, to set my intention, and using this external, you know, activity that you're not participating in for the entire time, but you have even just a little opportunity there in a small formal way to give yourself permission each time to take a breath and ground yourself and check in.
That's a great, great suggestion. It's so easy to be thinking about just what is coming next for you. You know, thinking about that big lick that you have to play in the third movement of something, or thinking about, you know, oh, that person sounds a little out of tune. I wonder why that is, or all these different things that could be running through your mind during the tuning note that you're not involved with. It's such a nice reminder, again, of that those little places where you can build the habit of checking in and dropping in and following the breath for just even a cycle or two to just really get yourself present where you are.
Yeah. The mind's going to wander either way. So you might as well give it something healthy and skillful to focus on, as opposed to that kind of fear and that anxiety in the future of what could happen, what might happen. So yeah, just giving yourself some healthy anchors there to just be and enjoy it and savor it. I think that's the other thing too, when I was running, you know, when I think back to my undergraduate time, I remember watching colleagues after their recital or, you know, and they just immediately they're done playing and they drop their hands or they drop their horn, not drop their horn, but you know, they, right. their whole, performance posture breaks before and the music's still reverberating in the room. And I think just even in a performance way, giving yourself permission again, even when you're running your scales, just at the end of your cycle, just hold it and savor that moment for what it is. Those little, like little glimpses of presence, I think are really cool that are all the way through our music, but we just rarely have like recognize or take a chance with.
Yeah. So many good reminders and good suggestions, Ben. I think we'll kind of start to wrap things up there for our first of, I hope, many conversations. But I'm sure there's lots of people listening who would love to kind of find out more about what you do and how to get in touch with you. So what are the best places for them to do that?
Sure. So this is it's a tricky thing because the whole point of these practices, in my opinion, is to kind of remove yourself from social media, but we do use it quite a bit. So I love Instagram for better or worse. And so at Zen with Ben on Instagram and my website, zenwithben.me. I'm based in Boulder and we've got, you know, Kevin, thank you. As you mentioned, my first book just came out, Mindfulness for Musicians. That's available now. And we just launched through Dragonfly Percussion, my signature series of singing bowl implements for both metal and crystal singing bowls just launched this week. So that's been really exciting. So a lot of my time outside of the orchestra is working with sound as a meditation and as a holistic wellness practice and bringing some of those tools from our music training. It does serve you. We don't want to convince anyone that, you know, through this mindfulness practice that the music is misguided. But I think the way that we approach it can be much more healthy and positive and connective and present. And that's the point of all this. So thank you for hosting this podcast too, because it's really cool to get this information out and have people connect with it so that hopefully they have an enjoyable music experience that they're present for and that they can actually listen to and hear themselves and enjoy it for what it is on this trajectory of their artistic journey.
Yeah, that's so much my hope is this idea of balance and of being able to be a great musician, you know, whatever that means for you, whatever definition that is for the individual, and to enjoy the process of making music rather than the feeling of constant inadequacy or of failure. And that's so present for so many musicians. It makes me so sad when I hear that and see that in my friends and colleagues and anyone I talk to that's in that boat. But I think a lot of what you're doing is, or everything you're doing is so great for the musical community and for the mindfulness and meditation community as well. And it was a real pleasure chatting with you today. So thank you again, Ben.
Thank you. Likewise. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Another big thank you to Ben for a great conversation. And thank you all so much for listening. You can keep up to date on all new episodes by following me on Instagram at Mindful Musical Life. or by visiting the website, mindfulmusicallife.com, where you can also get in contact with me directly to ask questions or suggest topics or guests for future episodes. I am also starting a new round of personalized mindfulness coaching, and if you would like more information about that, you can reach out via my website or Instagram to schedule a free consultation. Thank you again so much for listening, and see you next time.